From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 381, recorded live Thursday, July 18th, 2013. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Telerik, offering the best in developer tools and support. Online at telerik.com. And by franklins.net, makers of GesturePad, a powerful gesture recording and recognition system for Microsoft Kinect for Windows developers. Details at gesturepak.com. In this episode, Scott talks with Pete Brown about the upcoming Windows 8.1 update.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and I've got Pete Brown on the phone. How are you, Pete?
Good. How are you, Scott?
I'm good. I've installed Windows 8.1 on my Surface RT and on one of my laptops. And I got to say, it is 0.1 better. It really is. I mean that sincerely. It makes the RT usable.
Yeah, I mean, it really does help a lot there. I think it's better than 0.1 better, but you and I could debate that.
You want to call it Windows 8.7? I mean, what?
Yeah, like it's at least a 0.5 better or whatever. But
well, I like that it's only 0.1 because it gives us room for more points. There could be a 0.2, right?
right. But it's not like a service pack, right? It's not like an SP1. It's quite a bit more than that.
Definitely, I definitely agree with that. It's not just a bunch of fixes.
Yeah.
It's well, and frankly, it's kind of like the way the Mac operating system upgrades are. They come out and they say, you know, Snow Tiger or whatever has got 100 new features, you know, and I'm still discovering little things, little features in 8.1. Little corners of the operating system where stuff is new.
What's a 0.1 of an animal? Like, what's a 0.1 of a tiger or something like that? I don't know.
I don't know. Like, there's a tiger and then there's a white tiger. So, snow leopard.
Right. Okay. So I guess I could do different colors.
Right. It's improved, right? Because the snow leopard looks cooler.
Yeah. I mean, so like on Windows 8.1, you know how we usually do multiple service packs and stuff on the operating system, but like a lot of people don't realize that the service packs are done by a different engineering team, right? I think they're like sustained engineering or something, but this 8.1 is done by all the same people who did 8. So it's, you know, right from the core operating system guys, which is part of the point I wanted to make is that it makes it a real next version of the operating system. And I guess if we just use names, people would just think of it as the next name. But so that's why I think of it as more than just a 0.1 on there.
I see. So fixes come from the fixes group and features come from the main
group.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's cool. I noticed that there is, I was going to say the start button's back, but I wouldn't say that. A start button is back.
Yep. Yeah.
And when you click on it, it goes to the start screen.
It does. And I don't know if you've tried this yet, but if you change your start screen's background to be the same as your desktop wallpaper, like a lot of that context switch that everybody talked about, and that I honestly never thought was a big issue until I saw the fix for it, kind of goes away. Because now it looks like something that's just overlaying your desktop as opposed to, you know, bringing you out to a different screen.
Mm-hmm. So the start menu pops up, but the start screen, there I go again. There is no start menu.
Right. I mean, it's not a start menu. So we have the start screen, but then there's also the magical Windows X, right? I assume you of all people would probably know about that one.
Yeah. So when anyone is upset about Windows, before I tell them to like quit, just push Windows X and tell me if you're still ready to quit.
Right. I mean, so we added the shutdown stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
So it always had the control panel and updates and a bunch of other things there. But now at least you can shut down there because with Windows 8, I think they assumed that everybody would just hit the power button on their computer. But I like never really do that. You know, I either close a lid or on my desktop, I always shut down from a menu. And so that was buried. It was like 3 or 4 clicks to get to shutdown. So now that's quite a bit easier as well.
Well, and a couple other things added there. The Mobility Center, which is what Windows X used to bring up, is now there. PowerShell is in there too.
Yep.
Instead of, which is actually a change from Command Prompt. I don't know if that's a pretty subtle one, but some people might care. Command Prompt used to show up there. Now PowerShell shows up there.
Yeah.
Which is still, you know, you can still run stuff at the command prompt. And then also network connection. So it's really the power users menu.
Yeah. And so I think that's between that and the overlay of the start page over or start screen over your desktop background, I think that really helps a lot with the context switching. Not everybody's going to like it, you know, because it is a change from what we had before, but I think it makes a big difference.
Well, you glossed over that one a little bit. Having the background of the start menu be the same as your wallpaper.
Yeah, like, so this is what I was mentioning before, where that really gets rid of that context switch, where I've got this kind of spacey wallpaper background that spans my two screens here. Mm-hmm. And I have my start screen set up so that it uses that same background. So when I hit the Windows key and swap between those, it overlays my desktop background. It like it ghosts out a little bit and overlays it with the normal start screen tiles. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't give me that jarring context switch that so many people have talked about with Windows 8.
Yeah, that makes a huge difference. And I'll tell this, and you know, go tell the bosses or whoever you can tell, everyone, 100% of people that I have showed that feature to have said that they wish that was the default.
Yeah.
So I am really crossing my fingers that this is the default for when this ships. Because, I mean, even I showed it to my wife, and she's like, oh, like literally it was a moment that people think that, you know, pushing the start button on the keyboard or the start button on the screen launches you into this entirely new universe.
Right.
And that simple thing of changing the color to their background wallpaper makes everyone go, oh, okay, the buttons are bigger and they fill the screen. So I thought that was kind of cool.
It ties them together, you know, quite a bit better, right?
Yes, please tell the bosses.
Yeah, there's some other stuff like I just sort of stumbled across this one day where mm-hmm. you still have the 30-inch screens, right?
Yeah, I've got a 30 and two 24s.
So if you mouse into the corner to pull up the charms bar instead of using the hotkey, the charms now show up closer to where the corner where you moused into.
Right. Actually, yeah. So I've got two machines in front of me. One's 8, one's 8.1. On the 8.01, the charms are always centered vertically, which means I got to go to the corner and then go way up like 7 inches, 10 inches away.
Yeah. Which actually, because when you think about how you move a mouse, it's not a straight line. It's almost always an elliptical motion when you move a mouse. So you would get halfway up there and it would dismiss the charms bar or something like that because you would get out of the area, right? Mm-hmm. So this just makes that, I think, a lot more usable as well. And I stumbled across that and I was like, oh, well, duh. Of course, that's how I would want it to work, right?
Yeah, yeah. Little refinements like that.
Yeah, and I think those all, and when you add those to the idea that you can now boot directly to the desktop if you want, which is another, you know, big thing for a lot of, especially developers and power users, mm-hmm. I think all those things together really help smooth, you know, the transition into this.
Yeah, right? The one on the booting to the desktop is a little hard to find. You have to right-click on the taskbar and hit properties.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think we would want everybody and their brother to do that. It's one of those things that if you know it's going to make sense for you, then do it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, ultimately, you know, you want app developers to be able to have their apps visible to people when they turn on the machine, right? I mean, as an app developer, you want people to use your apps. And if everybody booted to the desktop, nobody would see those apps, right? So it would make it much harder for people to make money developing those. So I think that, you know, the boot to the desktop thing is just for the people who know that that's going to make them more efficient. But the default is always going right to the start screen.
Okay, that makes sense. The other thing that the start screen, I'm kind of up and down about this, is that the search is different. So when you hit the Windows key and start typing and then hit enter, it searches everything. And by everything, it searches the internet and it searches your computer.
Right. So the there's a good session on build about why search was changed to be this way. But for the most part, it was a lesson learned from Windows 8 where folks just found search to be non-discoverable, right? Having it over there in the charms bar when search was considered such an essential function was just really difficult for most people to figure out. Mm-hmm. And so on the start screen, and this is to me just a little bit confusing, just like what you're talking about. When on the start screen, when you do search through the charms bar, you get that sort of global search. Mm-hmm. But if you go down to the all apps, which is, you know, either swipe up on a touch screen or hover over and click the little down arrow on the bottom left on a mouse based system, there is, if I remember correctly, an in-page search there that is searching just your apps, right?
Ah.
And so this is consistent with how all the other Windows apps work, mm-hmm. where we've backed off from the idea that all your search must be in the charms bar, and instead said, you know, what's better for the users is to have search on the app's canvas, and then have this other global search, which is now brings you to that kind of Bing search, which has the, you know, the hero pages for big searches. And, you know, a really it's quite an interesting search experience for that, but it's not searching, you know, just like your apps or just inside a particular app.
Okay. But one of the things that I'm not able to find now, though, is how to search within an app. Like if I'm in Netflix and I go to search, I want to search Netflix.
Yeah,
but it's searching the universe, and I'm not interested in searching the universe.
So I think for 8.1, a lot of developers are going to go back and put the search bars or the, you know, the search boxes in their apps, and Netflix would probably be one of those. Mm-hmm. And quite honestly, so we have this process called AFT, App Fast Track, which does reviews of apps, right? Mm-hmm. And part of that review, like we always had customers that came to us and said, I want search on the screen. But the AFT review said, no, thou shalt not have search on the screen because that's not part of the standard. So most of these people wanted to do it that way, but just it wasn't something that fit the Windows 8 design style. Mm-hmm. And so for them to be able to go back and do it now, I think they'll be like, ah, finally, this is what we want.
Okay. So it's okay to do that now? Like it seems like with design guidelines, there's all these rules. Some of them are spoken, some of them are unspoken. It's okay to have search boxes now.
It's actually encouraged to have search boxes now. And there are a number of other, I spoke a little bit about this at Build. I mean, there are a number of other things that we've changed and quite honestly, we've relaxed on where a lot of it is if you're an app developer and you have an established brand, you know, don't let us get in the way of you bringing your brand forward. I mean, you need to do what's right for the users and do what's right for your brand. And then all the rest of it is just kind of making sure that, you generally fit Windows. Mm-hmm. Like we also encourage now having all of the necessary commands for your app on the canvas as opposed to hidden in an app bar. Right?
Okay.
So if you're doing something on the screen where you're going to always want to say, like, think about the mail client. You're going to want to send an email or something, right? It'd be kind of dumb to have to flick up on the app bar and then hit send to do that. I mean, so the send button is directly on the canvas
right.
for the app.
Don't hide stuff that's totally essential, important stuff to keep around.
Yeah. So we've updated a lot of that. And it's all just based on how people were using Windows mm-hmm. and then feedback that we got from all the different partners, right? So I think it's, you might look at it as sort of backpedaling a bit, but I'm really happy that we went and did that because you could sort of stick to a like kind of a crappy approach mm-hmm. or you can adjust it and do what people are really asking you to do and make everything better.
Yeah, if backpedaling is making it better, I don't care. Backpedal all you want.
Yeah.
As far as I'm concerned. Most people think of it as being tablet focused. I'm starting now after having used Windows 8 for some months to get used to switching back and forth and when to do things in the desktop and when things to do in video and full screen. Like I was on the plane yesterday and because the 8.1 preview includes Outlook on my Surface RT. Mm-hmm. Which really I didn't use before, but now it has Outlook. I use it more often. And what I ended up doing was I had half the screen movie and the other half was Outlook.
Yep.
And it's funny. It reminds me of these window managers that I used in kind of the Linux world where you didn't think about resizing windows. They resize themselves. Like I'm looking at my screen right now. I'm in desktop. I've got you in Skype desktop, the task manager. I've got a browser. I've got Outlook. I've got an agenda about what we're going to talk about today, but I'm having to move around and manage all of those. I wonder if Windows is moving towards a world where there's less window resizing.
Well, guys like you and me on the desktop, I think, you know, especially with multiple screens here and stuff, are still going to do better with individual windows that you can change not just their horizontal size, but their vertical size and stuff. So I still rely on that a lot, but you've been tech support for relatives before, right?
Sure.
You know, most relatives like run apps full screen all the time on their desktop.
Yeah, that's true, actually.
And if it's not visible, they assume it's not there. Like my dad used to open new instances of like Word every single time that he wanted to get to it because he didn't realize it was down in the taskbar, right? It's just like one of those kind of strange things. So if you think, you know, for the average person using a computer, they don't want to do window management. They just want to work in their app, right? And then when you combine that with the idea that window management with touch, I mean, I assume you've tried to use a touch screen with regular like window management before, like to resize windows and stuff. Now, it's not exactly friendly. You know, it's a bit of a pain in the butt. So having this simplified version where it's multiple side-by-side window panes, I think makes much more sense for both of those use cases. So where I've specifically have used it, which I think it is great on the, on something like the tablet, is when you open a link from your email client and then it just, you know, makes a screen half the size and then opens up IE over on the right with the link loaded in it. And so I think that was much better than the approach we had before with the 320 pixel wide snapped view, and then you had the rest of the screen, and those are the only two options.
Yeah, I'm starting to realize that there are certain things, and I don't think Windows 8.1 kind of nails it, but it's it's close in the idea that, you know, sometimes I just want to see this, and then I want the screen to split, and then when I close it, I want it to go back the way it was. And that doesn't require me right-clicking, opening in new windows, resizing, et cetera, et cetera. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And again, for power users and folks like us, right, you still have all the normal window management stuff that you can do. And on my desktop, that's just how I run all the time. And then on my laptop, I go half and half. Sometimes I do one, sometimes I do the other.
I've got three monitors. And one of the things that used to suck about Windows 8 was that I would put a full screen, something like Hulu or Netflix, over on one monitor. And then I'd be doing some other stuff. And then I'd like bump the start button, or I'd go and launch something, and then it would disappear. Is that fixed? So, that totally sucks.
So, I mean, you can have the apps on different screens, if I remember correctly. Here, I haven't done it here lately on this. But you can have the apps on different screens, right? And you can also have the taskbar properly span both screens if you have desktop going across the whole way. But I think probably the most important thing of all that is, are both your screens the same make and model? Or all three of your screens?
Dell, but they're years apart.
Right, but they probably all have the same DPI.
Now, I think so.
Yeah, like same resolution and same size, roughly.
Yeah, ballpark, okay. Sure.
Right, so, but that's not always the case. Like, some people will have a big main screen, and then they'll have like a 27-inch screen on the other side, but that 27-inch screen will be only 1920 by 1080 or something. So it has different DPI from the main screen that the person's working in. And so now in 8.1, you have per screen DPI settings, where the windows can be aware that the DPI for each different display that you have is different and can adjust the size of the content on there appropriately, where before it was, you know, one DPI across everything.
Right.
And for those of us who talk a lot, like you go and present at an event, and if you're on something like a Surface Pro, which has is going to run at like 125 or 150%, whatever that number is, because you're not going to use a Surface Pro at 1920 by 1080 natively because everything on it is super tiny. But when you project that stuff to a screen, you probably do want it to use the full 1920 by 1080 and use every pixel of that and not be scaled. So now those are two different screens and can have separate DPIs.
How does that work as you move a window between two screens? Like, does if it's straddling half and half, what happens?
So that's a little funky, actually. The minute that the window goes more than halfway onto one of the screens, it scales it using that DPI setting. So you'll see this like weird thing where you pull it halfway across the screen, and then the minute you get over that, you'll see it either bump up or bump down in size. And then move over. So it's kind of a funky effect, but once you realize what's happening, it makes perfect sense.
Interesting. I'm going to have to get an extra monitor to try that out. I don't know. That's a good question. I do have my Lenovo Carbon Touch that has a docking station.
Yeah.
I bet you that. Oh, yeah, that'll actually work.
Yeah, laptops are a perfect case for this, where they're almost always a higher DPI on the screen versus whatever external display you might hook up to it.
I'm actually plugging that in right now. I'm going to find out what this looks like. This is cool. Good information. Okay, that's cool. Now, I've got a Fitbit Flex on my wrist. It's Bluetooth 4. It's like super low power. And I knew that Bluetooth 4 was low power, but I didn't know that there's some features about it. Like, you don't really have to pair with it.
Like, yeah,
you know what I mean? Somehow it just knows that you care and you want to pair.
Yeah, I don't get super deep into that, but I do know that it's much easier to, you know, pair things. Like, you know, 10 years ago or whenever it was, it seems like 10 years ago when Bluetooth stuff first came out, I'm sure you remember, it was like pairing something was always agonizing. Like you would spend 10 minutes trying to pair just like a headset to your phone or something like that, and then realize you look kind of dumb with the headset anyway. it was always like this agonizing thing. So I know Bluetooth 4 has features to make that easier, but then it also has what the low energy profile that gives you, better energy usage and how it throttles the signals going across and how you can pair with more than one thing. So there's a lot of stuff there. And what's really kind of cool about that is that's all built into the APIs for 8.1. Mm-hmm. So there is a WinRT Bluetooth API, which you went over and visited Chris at Build, right? He had his agent.
Chris Walker from Secret Labs. I'm actually speaking with him at Monkey Space. Actually, by the time this is published, we will have had our talk.
Excellent. Right. So he had his agent smartwatch on there, which if people aren't familiar with it, it's very cool. It runs .NET micro framework. It has Bluetooth built into it and stuff. And he had a demo of communicating to that watch from Windows 8.1, just from a regular C# and XAML app, right? Which I think is really great now that we can use Bluetooth that way and communicate with these other devices just from managed code or from HTML and JavaScript or whatever you would like.
Yeah, I've actually done some work talking to USB stuff. I tried talking to a USB serial port thing. I tried talking to a space orb. I tried talking to blood sugar meters. And the only game in town was this crappy library called USB Sharp. And it was so low level. I mean, it was just like pulling teeth. And it just made me hate USB. Like if you're not doing USB code in C++, then it's just over for you.
Yeah, and 8.1 also adds in USB APIs, but they're so on the main USB API, it's WinUSB. So it's important to know that that's not like there are a lot of hobby things that use serial over USB. Like they'll open up a virtual COM port on your machine and stuff. And I always feel like I've been thrown back 20 years whenever I see something crack open like COM 6 on my machine, right?
Sure.
So it just seems kind of nuts. So it's not that kind of communication, but anything which can use either a WinUSB driver or show up as a human interface device, you know, HID, those APIs are also now part of WinRT.
Okay. So people use the serial port ones, though, because there's nothing better. Is this
just
better?
Because they're real easy. Uh-huh. It's super easy to communicate over serial. Like doing WinUSB stuff requires a little bit more work. And so, you know, the product team's aware of this and they're looking at it to see what they'll do long term. I think the fact that, you know, serial over USB is used so heavily, especially in the hobby communities, was somewhat surprising to them because it seems like such an ancient technology that nobody would use anymore.
Yeah, exactly. This is cool. So being able to plug hardware in is important to me. Like I mentioned the blood sugar meters. We're always trying to figure out ways to talk to these USB APIs. The other thing that was cool at Build was next to Chris Walker from Secret Labs was all the 3D printers. People were going nuts printing out stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, and they were everywhere. You know, you literally could not walk around there without bumping into a 3D printer someplace. And the main reason for that is we've added in 3D printer support to Windows 8.1. And you might wonder, like, what does that mean? Because if anybody who's familiar with 3D printing knows that the pipeline is usually, you know, design a model using some sort of CAD software, and then run it through like a slicing program, which generates the different layers that are going to be printed out. And then there's some sort of communication to a printer, and it's either a USB connection or save this G code off to a USB key or something, and then go plug it directly into the device or whatever, right? So there's built-in support for 3D printing now that's kind of, it's akin, actually it's very highly related and part of the regular printing APIs. Mm-hmm. So that somebody can use the print charm, and if the app supports 3D models and stuff, they'll be able to just directly print to these printers. Which, at first you might think, well, for hobbyist guys, that doesn't, what's that getting them? And it's probably not getting the hobby guys a whole lot yet, all right? But what it's really doing is it's going to make it so that 3D printers start becoming much more consumer friendly, and also quite a bit cheaper. So you remember, back in the day, regular printers like laser printers and stuff required a lot of onboard smarts to print. Like right. they had, you know, all their own controllers and they had, you know, their own CPUs and everything inside there. And then eventually we came up with this idea. I think we called it, was it the WinPrint or WinPrinter or something like that?
Yeah.
Where the printers no longer had the logic on the printer. It was using stuff inside the PC. And that was, you know, very controversial at the time because people saw it as using more resources on the PC, but it made it so you could have like $30 printers, right? Because
right,
they
exactly.
just, they, yeah. And so
well, I remember waiting, you know, 15 minutes for the printer's processor to like orient the page or create the page and think about it. And we would have times where you'd print six pages and one of them would run out of memory. So then you'd yeah. only get a few of the pages printed.
Yeah. And, but what, so, and then once the you know, the OEMs and the hardware guys caught up with what they actually needed to put in these printers to make them work well, it became a non-issue. But so I can see us doing a similar thing with 3D printing, where right now the cheapest consumer-friendly 3D printer, is like $1,300, right? And that's, you can get that at Staples. There's a, what's it called? Cubify 3D printer. And it's made to be very, very consumer friendly. Now, for those that want to build them themselves and everything, you can do it for $300-$400, right? But the being able to have these consumer facing printers and these consumer ready printers drop in price because they're selling more of them and because they have to have less logic inside is going to make 3D printing much more reasonable for us to do to, like, say, buy a 3D printer so our kids can create action figures and stuff, right? And do their crafts. Like if you need to build a DNA model for, you know, for your science class when you're in middle school, mm-hmm. you don't have to go to the craft store and buy, you know, 30 foam balls to do it. You can print out, you know, you can design the model in 3D and print out that 3D model directly there.
Yeah. Somebody said that, the number one, market for 3D printers is replacing battery doors on stuff where battery doors have fallen off. I look forward to someone making a website that is nothing but me typing in what I've lost the battery door for and then the 3D printing thing to let me print that battery door out.
That's so true. And people make all sorts of replacements for broken parts and stuff like that. And it's one of those things where it's just starting. You know, the big question right now, everybody says, well, what would I use that for? And if you remember, people used to ask the same things about computers. It's like, well, what would I use that computer for? You know, why do I need a computer? It was a question at one point.
Right.
So it's going to be, I think, the same thing here, where eventually it's just going to become an essential piece of kit in people's houses. Now, I actually used a 3D printer in some of the work I did for the keynote at Build on day two. Nobody can necessarily tell it was 3D printed, but I'll put together something about that maybe next week or something like that that explains where I use 3D printing just as part of my job.
Yeah, I'd like to be able to see it where you can't tell that something's 3D printed. Like I kind of bugged the MakerBot guy a little bit where I was like, well, this is cute if I want to make little figurines that are all red.
Right.
You know, but then you go to look at some of the other 3D printers and they had some like Warhammer figurines or some kind of gaming figurines. And I could not tell without really looking close that these were not. I don't know if they painted them or they used multicolor techniques, but it's getting close.
So there are three main types, or probably four, but there are three main types of 3D printers. The consumer ones use this fused deposition approach, which is they basically spit out a stream of molten plastic and build up a model from that. And that's the one where you can usually see the layers. And that's where all the consumer oriented ones are. They use a big long filament of plastic and they spit that out through a hot nozzle, right? But there's another kind, and these are huge. They're like, you know, the size of Xerox copy center type things, where they have a layer of powder. And then they use something that looks like an inkjet that goes over it and sprays a colored fusing material, some sort of an adhesive, mm-hmm. and builds it up layer by layer that way. And what you get out of that is a sort of, you still end up with kind of a powdery texture, like it's like you can tell it was built up from some sort of powder, but you don't see individual layers and you can have any number of different colors built into that. So that's where some of those models that you saw, which look like there are multiple colors and they were huge and lots of different parts. So that's another big one. It would be nice to see those, become more consumer friendly, but you know, you have to replace powder cartridges and all sorts of things. So there's more going on there. And then the third one is the liquid resin. where they use a laser to harden layers of liquid resin. And that's the one where I've seen you get some of the best results in terms of like fidelity and resolution. Mm-hmm. But they're really tiny and they take a very long time. And you have to have a vat of liquid resin, which that's not kid friendly, right?
Yeah, well, I think it needs to get to the point where it's like a laser printer. Yeah. I think all of these things you're describing are cool and interesting, but there's no way that it's going to pop and Joe Public is going to buy one of these unless it's at Staples and it's $100 and the ink just works.
Yeah. So that first one that I mentioned, the Cubify one, is at Staples, which is pretty cool. It's not $100. But what I do like is they've made it so that the filament cartridges, you basically plug them in. They have a little chip inside them that knows what color it is and how much filament is left. And it'll warn you if there's not enough filament left or anything like that. So it does really bridge that gap and make things much more consumer friendly.
That's cool. And then if I just plug it in and I don't need any extra drivers, and certainly not multiple steps, like I want to plug it in, have it figure the drivers out, get them from wherever it needs to get them.
Yep.
And then, download the model of whatever I want, you know, the Lego man leg or whatever, pay somebody 99 cents, and then print it and it works. That's how it's got to work.
I mean, hobby guys like to be able to tweak all the settings to get the best possible print, but, you know, Joe Consumer just wants to hit print and have a model come out. So
right. And I know I just actually on my inkjet printer, I've got an HP all-in-one. I just said align heads, right? Like as far as I'm concerned, that's how you tweak the thing. You go and you do a test print. I'll tell you which one went better. I'm sure someone will make it so it'll print out 3 Super Mario guys and I'll tell them which one looks best. And then it'll know that that's the one that's going to happen.
Yeah. So exactly. And for the hobby folks that are listening on this, so, you know, understand that this is completely optional. This is just to make 3D printing more mainstream and more friendly for consumers. And then everybody who does want to do that little bit of tweaking or build rep wraps themselves, I mean, you can continue to do that, no problems at all. But I think the idea of having this in a lot more consumers' hands will make it much more friendly and then also just much cheaper.
Yeah, definitely cool. Okay. Well, when am I going to get this? I've got 8.1 preview. Am I going to have to torch my machine to get the final version on?
No, as I understand it, you will be upgrade from 8.1 preview to the final. And then, you know, everybody else will have it just as something through the Windows Store. Mm-hmm. So when this becomes available to the public at general availability, that which will be later this year, they'll just go into the Windows Store and they'll be able to upgrade, or they'll see apps which say they require Windows 8.1 and they'll be prompted to upgrade. And it's a free process. It's done through the store. You don't have to swap 30 floppies to do it or anything like that, right? It's pretty painless.
That's cool. Okay. So this sounds like you said later this year. So that means before Christmas, I will have this on my machine and my wife's machine will just get a notification that it's here.
Yeah. And then if developers who want to play with it now, it is available on, you know what? I don't have the link. You have to put it in the show notes.
Preview.windows.com.
There we go. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. Thank you.
No
and
worries.
That, what that does, it installs something on your machine, like an MSI, which then after you reboot, makes it so the store link for upgrading to Windows 8.1 is now available. So you are going to go through the same general process that people are at the end of the year.
Very cool. Okay. That's good. Yeah, I know that there was some talk about whether some machines get torched or not, but like on the Windows on the Surface RT, it wasn't a big deal. I did lose my apps, but then it brought them back down automatically from the store, so I didn't really lose anything.
Yeah, so it remembered which apps I had installed, but it didn't have the apps themselves there. And that's another thing that's in 8.1 is really nice, is apps will auto-update from the store. Like, you don't have to go into the store and manually say, I want to update these 5 apps, because nobody did that. So part of enabling that also makes it so when your apps come down from the upgrade, they just automatically update.
Sounds like as an app developer, make sure you don't screw up the update is going to be very important.
Of course, but then on the plus side, your users will actually have the updates.
Everyone's guaranteed to get the updates.
Yep. And then let me do a plug here. So if you are interested in coding for Windows 8, I have a book, of course. There are lots of good books out there, but I also have mine. If you go to bit.ly/PeteWindowsBook, it'll show up there. That's remaining.
Okay. I'll put that bit.ly/PeteWindowsBook in the show notes as well. Thanks for talking to me.
Cool. Cool. Thanks, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.